Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is astronomy in the Bay Area and beyond, with renowned local astronomer, writer, and educator, Andrew Fracknoy. Many of us don't realize it, but our region is an aspiring astronomer's dream. We are home to the Lick Observatory, the world's oldest permanent mountaintop observatory. We're also home to the SETI Institute, the Mountain View institution devoted to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And we've got a wealth of science museums and amateur and professional societies dedicated to the teaching and study of astronomy. So this hour, we'll explore some local astronomy-related themes. What's the best way to view next month's solar eclipse? Where can like-minded amateur astronomers gather to share ideas? And we'll also take a tour of some of astronomy's big and persistent questions. What exactly is a black hole? And how close are we to discovering life beyond Earth? Joining me in studio for what should be a fun and wide-ranging discussion is Andrew Fracknoy, professor of astronomy at Foothill College, where he teaches courses in astronomy and physics. A prolific public lecturer, scholar, and author, Professor Fracknoy wrote the college textbook Voyages Through the Universe, has edited two collections of science articles and science fiction stories for Bantam Books, and wrote the children's astronomy book, Disney's Wonderful World of Space. He is also the founding editor of the online magazine Astronomy Education Review. He is also affiliated with numerous astronomy-related organizations, including the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, where he served as executive director for 14 years, Project Astro, a program he co-founded that trains astronomers to work in classrooms, and the SETI Institute, dedicated to the search for extraterrestrial life. He also organizes and moderates Cosmos in the Classroom, a conference he founded on teaching astronomy to non-science majors. Professor Fracknoy has received numerous awards, including California's Professor of the Year Award, given by the Carnegie Endowment for Higher Education, and the Annenberg Foundation Prize of the American Astronomical Society. And in recognition of his work in sharing the excitement of modern astronomy with the public, the International Astronomical Union named Asteroid 4859 Asteroid Fracknoy. Andrew Fracknoy, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Later in the program, we will invite you, our listeners, to call in and join the conversation. You can email or text us right now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Andrew, let's start by talking about making astronomy accessible to the layperson. That's really something that you have specialized in over the years. Why is it so important to do that, and how do you take these incredibly complicated concepts and break them down in a way that the average person can understand?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, actually. When you look at what we've been discovering in astronomy, this is almost a second golden age, if you will, of astronomy. And a lot of that is financed by public money. It's the government, it's educational institutions that are government-supported that are behind so much of the astronomical discovery. And I think we scientists have an obligation in return for all the support to explain our work clearly and non-technically so everyone can share in the excitement. But also, it seems to me it would be such a pity to, in a sense, fence off these exciting new discoveries from so many of the members of the public by making it technical or mathematical. So I've always been trying in my teaching and in my writing to find everyday language and analogies and some humor to explain these concepts so that everyone can understand them.
And what are the hooks to get the average person interested in this? Of course, there are people who are extremely interested in this, but the average person may think, that's not for me. I don't have a scientific mind. What are your hooks to make them feel we all should know about this?
Well, and that's a great question. I have a variety of hooks depending on the circumstances. But, for example, one of the things I try to tell my students that just now, the fall quarter starting today at Foothill College, and I had my first group of students come in, and what I try to tell them is that astronomy is not so abstract. It's not so removed. We can show, and we do during the course of my course, that everything that we are made of, all our atoms, everything that puts us together as human beings, actually came from the stars, not in the shoo-shoo way that astrologers might talk about the stars influencing our destiny or our lives, but in a real physical way. If you look at your body, Every atom in your body, with a few exceptions, once was inside a star, which later exploded, became recycled into the universe at large. And when our sun and our earth formed about 5 billion years ago, we actually incorporate atoms that were made inside other generations of stars. So in that sense, I tell my students, we're all stardust. We're all made of the stuff of the stars. That's one way. Another way that I enjoy talking about, we could talk about some of this, is that when I teach about the planets, I have my students imagine that a few years from now, we're going to have tourism in outer space. Where will we go? What will be the not-to-be-missed tourist sites around the planets, where if you take a trip and you don't go see this site and you come back, Aunt Clara's going to say, that's the cheapo trip you had? How come you didn't go to the giant volcano on Mars? That's the number one tourist site. So it's fun to get students to sort of think about these ideas in everyday terms.
Well, you're bringing up a bunch of ideas we'll circle back to later in the conversation. But I want to talk about the SETI Institute next, which you have really been a part of from the beginning, based here in the Bay Area. And I'm wondering if you could start by talking about how it got started and your involvement from the beginning. And then we'll get to the very exciting things that it's up to right now.
Well, that's a slightly longer story, but I'll try to give you the gist of it. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It's the old and wonderful question, mostly science fiction until recently: are there alien intelligences? Could we have KALW listeners among the stars? And for the longest time, this was science fiction. It was speculation. Philosophers talked about it. But science had no way of establishing whether or not there could be aliens out there living, intelligent creatures on planets around other stars. And now in this last few decades, this period of the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, that has changed. For the first time, we are within reach of answering that question scientifically. In particular, we can now communicate with aliens around other stars just the same way that right now we're communicating with KALW listeners. If you think about why it is that you're hearing this City Visions program right now, there are waves that are being broadcast from the KALW transmitter, which travel invisibly and at the speed of light out throughout the Bay Area. And whether you're at home or in your car, those so-called radio waves are getting to the antenna of your car or the antenna in your home and being translated into the discussion that David and I are having. So in that same way, if you had a more powerful transmitter, you could imagine sending messages not just to the other side of the Bay Area, but to the moon, to Mars, or even to the stars. And that's what we're envisioning, that it's possible that alien civilizations, for purposes of their own, might be sending out radio messages and that we could intercept theirs, or that ours could someday reach them. And that notion was sufficiently legitimate, sufficiently scientifically reasonable, that NASA got into this in a pretty serious way in the 1980s and early 1990s. And NASA began a program of using some of NASA's antennas and NASA's equipment, with some help from really smart people in Silicon Valley, to search for alien messages that might be coming from the stars. And right as NASA got started, a grandstanding senator from Nevada stood up on the floor of the Senate and said, I can't believe that our tax dollars are being used to search for little green men. I'm going to put a stop to this right now. And he dared his colleagues to vote for the search for little green men. And as a result, NASA was forbidden to search for intelligent life among the stars, what is probably one of the most exciting projects that humankind could ever undertake, and NASA was forbidden to do it. So NASA was in a tight box. What were they going to do? They had all this equipment. They just invested millions of dollars in what would be this upcoming search, and they weren't allowed to do it. So that's when Bernard Oliver, who was vice president at that time of Hewlett-Packard and a great visionary in Silicon Valley, and a number of other people, Frank Drake, who's sort of the father of the scientific search for life elsewhere, got the idea to found a nonprofit organization to do the work that NASA was now forbidden to do. And they called it the SETI Institute, and I was very fortunate to be asked when they first founded this to be on the board representing education and public outreach. So for the last 25 years, the organization has been doing what NASA can't do, which is to search for signals. We've built new telescopes. We've undertaken very complex programs of decoding, understanding how to take messages and decode them. So if the aliens are not broadcasting in English, for example, we could still tell that they're out there. And there are very exciting programs that are continuing to go on in the Institute many years later.
Now, let's talk about the search for planets that could possibly house this life, because I know very recently there's been a spectacular increase in finding the number of planets that are Earth-like out there.
Well, you're exactly right. This is perhaps the most exciting development in this entire field. As late as 25 years ago, we knew zero planets orbiting other stars. Absolutely, the only planets we knew about, planets like Earth, were the ones that orbited our sun. Planets like Mars, planets like Venus, the ones that you may have heard about in your elementary education. That was it. The stars are so far away that any planets orbiting them reflect so little light that no telescope on Earth or above the Earth could actually take a picture at that time of a planet orbiting another star. The planets were just too dim to see. And yet we wanted desperately to know, was Star Trek right? Right? In Star Trek, every week, the spaceship Enterprise would go to a different star system, and there'd always be this planet there where there were either aliens or interesting things to do. Wouldn't it be great if the real universe were like that? If every time you stopped off at some other star, there was a family of planets just like our own. And in the last 25 years or so, through some spectacular advances in instruments and telescopes, we are now able to detect planets around other stars. The first one was detected in 1995. And as of today, I just checked before we came on the air, there are almost 2,000 planets known to orbit other stars. So we've gone from zero to 2,000. The experts in the field say the 2,000 is just the cliche tip of the iceberg. Those are the easiest ones to find, and that there could well be millions and millions of planets orbiting other stars just in our neighborhood of the Milky Way galaxy. If planets are there, since we developed on a planet, we needed the sheltering environment of a planet to develop. If the planets are there, that makes it more likely that living beings could exist, because planets could shelter them and help them evolve just the way the Earth sheltered us and helped us to evolve. So suddenly the question of life out there has gotten this incredible shot in the arm from the discovery of all these planets in our neighborhood, if you will.
So we found these planets, and now some of the research is, so what is the atmosphere like on these planets? What do we need to find to posit that there is more likely to be life on a planet?
Right. So this is where we want to be very careful. We always hear in science fiction and on popular programs about life as we know it. And then students always ask me, well, what about life as we don't know it? And I have to explain that, well, we don't know it yet, so what can I tell you? But we don't want to jump to any conclusions that would be Earth chauvinist. You know, you can be a male chauvinist and think that males are better than females. So if you're an Earth chauvinist, you think everything has to be like the Earth. And we don't want to make that mistake. We don't want to be Earth chauvinist and think only the Earth's environment could give rise to life or intelligent life. There may be planets with different environments, different atmospheres, different conditions, and they may give rise to different looking creatures, different chemistries, but they may still be intelligent as well. Still, if we're going to start, we have one example of intelligent life in the universe, which is us. So at the start, we're going to look for things that are like us. And very much the aim of this whole planet search, which we call exoplanet search. If a planet is not in our neighborhood, we call it an exoplanet. The aim of this exoplanet search is to find an Earth 2.0. At least at the beginning, we want to find a replica of the Earth. And we're almost there. We have found planets that are at the same distance from their stars as the Earth, but not exactly the same size as the Earth. And then we found planets that are exactly the same size as the Earth, but not quite at the right distance from their planet. We're still searching for the exact duplicate of the Earth, where it's both our size and at the exact distance from the star that we are from the sun. But if you're not so restricted in what you're searching for, then we're already there. We found, if not twins of the Earth, cousins of the Earth, planets that are very likely to be habitable, to have the right environment. Now, at first, we're only seeing glimpses out there. We don't see a lot of detailed information. But there is now a whole program, which is just getting started, to allow us to read what the atmospheres of some of these planets are made of. Sarah Seeger, a brilliant astrophysicist at MIT, has been coming up with very clever techniques to look at the light of the star and the light of the planet and subtract the two so that we actually get some information about what the chemical composition of the atmospheres of these exoplanets is like. And we found water. We found carbon dioxide. We found a number of the things that we have on Earth in some of these alien atmospheres already, and the work is just starting. So this is very exciting stuff. The next 10 years, I think, will allow us to have a much better sense of what these alien planets are really like.
And are these findings surprising you? I mean, it seems to me, logically, with billions and billions of stars, it's highly likely that we would have found this. We just didn't have the instruments to do it. So is this something you felt in your bones for a long time, but only now have evidence exists?
Wonderful question. Yes, absolutely. I think most scientists, if you had asked them, especially if you'd given them a drink or something like that, and you had asked them, well, now, what do you really think about planets out there? They would have said, well, of course, I'm a scientist and I need to wait for the evidence and all that. But deep in my heart, yes, it seems pretty unlikely that of all the worlds out there, of all the possible stars out there, there are probably 200 billion stars in our little galaxy alone, that out of all of them, only the sun would have had planets. That seems completely ridiculous, as your question implies. Still, it's nice to have evidence. It's much better than speculating to actually have direct signals of light and other radiation from these planets. Now, you asked me about surprises. We were actually surprised by the first planets we discovered. In the method that we have, where we actually look for the pull of the planet on its star to discover a planet, the most easy planets to find were planets that were very close to their stars. And to our surprise, we found giant planets very close to their stars. In our solar system, there are giant planets. Jupiter is a good example of a giant gas and liquid planet, but it's far from the star. And we had always taught our students, well, cute little planets like the Earth are close to their stars. Giant planets are far away from their stars, because we had only one example, our own solar system. But now we're finding that's not true. Giant planets are actually found very close to their stars, spookily close to their stars, medium close to their stars, far away from their stars. So the distribution of planets, how planets are arranged out there, turns out to be far more diverse than we ever thought possible. And that's neat. That's just intellectually very exciting. And that means that that nature can arrange families of planets in any way it wants, it seems.
We have a lot more to talk about. First, we're going to take a short break. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing astronomy with my guest, Andrew Fracknoy, professor of astronomy at Foothill College. Shortly, we'll be asking you to call in and join our conversation. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website, klw.org. Now, let's turn from, you talked about the federal political fight over SETI to a local political fight happening now over the Lick Observatory. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the observatory and As has been reported in the news, the University of California is saying that due to funding constraints, it won't be able to continue to fund LIC several years from now, and that private funders are going to have to step up. There is a fierce resistance to that going on in the astronomy community right now. So I guess could you start by telling us a little bit about the history of LIC and why it is still important today?
All right. Well, so this is part of the Bay Area history. We have to go back to the gold rush time, actually, to get this history started. Back in the days of the gold rush, there was a gentleman by the name of James LIC who made some money actually importing Peruvian wood and building pianos out of them for everybody on the West Coast. At that time, San Francisco, this is before the gold rush, was a pretty small community, and he made enough money to buy quite a bit of real estate. He owned what today we would call Market Street, the heart of downtown San Francisco. Then the gold rush came in, and suddenly his real estate was incredibly valuable, and Mr. LIC was one of the richest men in the United States. As he got older, he didn't have any children, he began to think about his legacy. And he wanted to build, as a monument to himself, the world's largest pyramid on Market Street. That was his ambition. And a group of city officials went to Mr. LIC and said, well, Mr. LIC, we love you, and of course you own this real estate so you can build whatever you want, but please, please, please don't build a pyramid in downtown San Francisco. That's not part of our development thoughts for the city. He said, well, if I can't...
Imagine trying to get that built today. Yeah, you'd never get through.
So he actually asked the delegation or committee of people who were sent to him, all right, if I can't build the world's largest pyramid in memory of myself, what can I build? And they said, well, how about if you build the world's largest telescope? And he said, that's a great idea. Then my name will be known on earth and in the heavens. And he gave money, an enormous amount of money. Today, it doesn't sound that much, but at that time, it was, somebody calculated, the equivalent of over $1 billion of today's money to build the largest and most advanced observatory, a place that houses a telescope. And he was very wise. He listened to his advisors. At that time, we were starting to realize that observatories couldn't go where the astronomers lived because the lights were going to overwhelm them and the clouds were pretty bad in places like San Francisco. They had to go high on top of mountains. And so the first serious mountaintop observatory built anywhere was the LIC Observatory. It was finished in 1888, dedicated, and it immediately made great discoveries. For example, the very first, one of the very first projects done with the LIC Observatory telescope was to discover a fifth moon of Jupiter. Galileo had discovered four moons of Jupiter. No one had found another moon since then. And right away with this new telescope, they found a fifth moon of Jupiter. So the telescope became very famous. The observatory grew and developed. It's on Mount Hamilton, just off from where San Jose has its center. And it continued to be a major instrument for most of the 20th century. Not just one instrument, but a number of telescopes were built on the mountaintop. In the meantime, we've built other telescopes. The University of California, for example, has an interest in a big telescope in Hawaii called the Keck Telescope. But the LIC Observatory has remained an agile place where you could try out new techniques, try out new instruments, and especially train graduate students who would someday make tomorrow's discoveries. You can't use the world's biggest telescopes to train graduate students because hundreds of astronomers are standing in line to use the really big modern telescopes. You need to have a set of smaller telescopes still on top of a mountain where you can train students, as I say, try out instruments, and do the kinds of projects that don't require a giant telescope but require huge amounts of time. There are projects like searching for planets that require hundreds of hours on a telescope. A big telescope is not going to give any single astronomer hundreds of hours because it has to be shared among many astronomers. So the LIC Observatory continues to be this vital place, and now comes the budget crunch that we all faced in the state of California, and perhaps understandably, the president's office at the University of California, which has been running the LIC Observatory along with other research facilities for the University of California as a whole, announced a few years ago that they would stop supporting LIC Observatory with their own state money and that the LIC Observatory was on its own. And the Lick Observatory really had never had to be on its own, so this was a great shock, like throwing your little brother into a pool of ice water. It really wakes you up. And so a brilliant and very dedicated astronomer at Berkeley named Alex Filipenko, who's a well-known teacher as well, has formed what is called the Lick Observatory Council, an organization of a number of us, both in astronomy and in the private corporate community, to try to save Lick Observatory from the budget axe, both to convince the University of California to continue some modest level of support to show that it is still interested in the observatory, and then to find other sources of support in the Silicon Valley and other parts of the Bay Area community. This Lick has always been known as the Bay Area Observatory. It's the one major research observatory anywhere in Northern California like this, and so we'd very much like to see it continue.
And what are the next steps? Is there any new word from UC, or is there a schedule that you need to be able to raise a certain amount of funds by?
We're not sure. There was just recently, and I think you can find this online, an excellent article in the Daily Californian, the student paper at UC Berkeley, which set out all the different sides to this and had comments from all the principals. And we're still waiting to see whether the University of California will give us some sort of earnest money. It would be a lot easier for those of us trying to raise money if we didn't have to do it all. If we could say, look, the University of California is still dedicated to this important facility. They're putting in some amount of money, and we just have to raise the rest. And that's not out of the question. There are certainly people at the University of California leadership level and people at the various campuses who are urging President Napolitano and others to take another look at this, to maybe make a small but serious investment in the observatory. And then we can begin to see how much money we need to raise and where we go. The other possibility is that Lick is a wonderful educational site. It's a place where we could train teachers. It's a place where the excitement of astronomy could serve to really begin to undertake STEM education, science, technology, and mathematics education. And that might be another role that Lick could play. It could become an educational center as well as a center for astronomical research. So we're looking at all these possibilities.
Okay, and you are listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing astronomy with my guest, Andrew Fracknoy, professor of astronomy at Foothill College. We invite you to call in with any astronomy-related questions or comments. Do you need any tips about observing our local night sky? Are you an educator interested in bringing astronomy to your classroom? Are there any big cosmic questions you want answered? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Let's start by going to our first call. Steve from San Francisco, welcome to City Visions.
Hi there. Great program. I'm so excited to be able to talk to you guys. And, of course, happy equinox, everyone. Now, I'm looking forward to our next lunar eclipse. The last one was on my birthday, and it was all cloudy and overcast, and we couldn't see anything. So we're looking forward to the upcoming one. Dr. I have two quick questions. One is, what portion or percentage do you think of the population knows the reasons that we have different seasons? I think a lot of people think it's because of the distance from the Earth to the Sun. And, of course, there's a different reason I know that you'll be more than happy to tell us about. And then, secondly, I see this guy who wrote a book called The Copernicus Complex. And so how different is our solar system and our sun than the other ones out there across the skies?
Wow, well, thank you so much. You've raised a lot of topics. Let's start with how you began, which is Happy Equinox. Let's explain that to our listeners. So today is actually the autumnal or fall equinox. That's the day when roughly the length of the day and the length of the night are equal. Equinox means equal night, and the night is equal to the day. We're going from the summer when the days were longer toward the winter when the nights are longer, and this is the balance point between the two. So, yes, let's wish everybody a happy fall equinox. You also mentioned eclipses, and indeed there is an eclipse of the moon coming up October 8th, but I have bad news. This eclipse is going to be in the middle of the night, and so that's not going to be great for people who like to sleep.
I'm going to stay up.
You are a dedicated astronomy buff.
I love it. It's beautiful.
But I think for most people, the eclipse begins at about 3:25, the total part. The partial begins about 2:15 a.m., and it won't end till 5:34 a.m. But that's a terrible time for most working people or people who are in school, and it's a Wednesday. So Wednesday, October 8th, if you happen to be a night owl and if you're up, look for the full moon in the middle of the night. It will slowly have the shadow of the Earth move across the full moon until the moon is kind of darkish, brownish red, and then the shadow of the Earth will move off it. But as far as eclipses are concerned, there's better news later in October. If you're an eclipse fan, on Thursday, October 23rd, there will be an eclipse of the sun visible from the Bay Area. Now, we have to say right at the beginning that the sun is not good to look at for any length of time. It's dangerous to your eyes if you stare at the sun without protection. But there will be a partial eclipse of the sun starting about 2 p.m. in the afternoon and ending about 4:32. And many of the Bay Area's institutions, colleges and observatories and planetaria, will have eclipse parties. So I'm sure there'll be much more information about that in the media when we get closer to October 23rd. We'll have websites up to tell people. But if you want to put something on your social calendar about the sky, put the afternoon of Thursday, October 23rd, on your calendar. About 40% of the sun's area, as seen from the Bay Area, will be covered by the moon. So it'll be called a partial eclipse of the sun.
Now, we have some other callers coming on, but Steve did have other questions. If you could give a quick answer to Steve,
sure.
And then we can move on to some
of
our other callers.
So he asked about the seasons. Yes, many people think it's cold in winter and hot in summer because in summer we're closer to the sun, and in winter we're further away. And that's actually not the main reason for the seasons on Earth. Turns out it's because the Earth is leaning. Long ago, our planet got hit by a large object, and like many accident victims, we can't stand up straight. You've known people like that, had a terrible accident, and now they're leaning over. Our planet Earth is like that. We're leaning over a little bit. We have a tilt of our axis, and when we lean into the sun, that's when we get summer. When we lean out of the sun, that's when we get winter in the northern hemisphere. So it's the tilt of the Earth that's the real reason for the seasons. And the caller also mentioned a new book called The Copernicus Complex by a professor at Columbia University. He's actually going to be here. His name is Caleb Scharf, and he's going to come and give a lecture, a free public lecture at Foothill College on October 8th. October 10th, which is...
give out your website
we'll get to the right date. I'm having a senior moment about the exact date, but I think it's Wednesday, October 8th, that he's coming to Foothill College to give a free public lecture in the evening. And his question is, the Copernicus Complex is all about, was Copernicus right that there's nothing that special about us? Copernicus said, we're not the center of the universe. We're just one planet among many orbiting the sun. Was he right in a larger sense? Are we just one abode of life, among many others, just what we were talking about in the first half of the show. He has ways in which, in this book, he set out why we are not that special, and therefore, if we're not that special, it's likely that there could be intelligent civilizations all around us in the vastness of space. So that's the Copernicus Complex book, which I think has just been published this week.
Steve, thanks again for your call. Let's now go to Nick from San Francisco. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had a couple of questions, but the first one is, I live in San Francisco. I don't have a car. Where, if you know, where would be a good place to just kind of stare and look at the stars at night in San Francisco, from San Francisco? And then the other is, with all the building and everything, are there any policies to help mitigate light leakage from the ground up?
Very good question. So San Francisco is a tough call for astronomy. I love San Francisco, my favorite city, and I enjoy living there. But as you know, San Francisco has fog most of the time. So for people who live in San Francisco, even when other parts of the Bay Area are clear, it's foggy in San Francisco. I like to go to Twin Peaks, actually, if you want a place in San Francisco where you can get a high, not in the Haight-Ashbury sense, but in the astronomical sense. That's a good place to go, is on Twin Peaks. Often when there are celestial events, there are amateur astronomers out there with their telescopes showing people what's going on. Now, as far as your second question is concerned, light pollution. What you're talking about is light pollution. Light pollution is one of the great challenges of astronomy in our time. Even the Lick Observatory, which is on an isolated mountain and pretty high up, suffers from the lights of San Jose being so close to it. As our civilization expands, our lights have gone everywhere we go without ever worrying about the fact that lights can go up as well as down. Only recently, because electricity has become more expensive, have we had city governments worrying about all the light we waste shining up. If you think about it, if you take a typical look at a typical street light, it shines up as much as it shines down. But there's no one up there who needs the light, right? The light is needed down on the ground where we want to walk or where we want to see what we're doing. So more and more governments are waking up to this issue of light pollution, of wasted energy on light that shines into the sky, and are buying light fixtures that reflect things down to the ground, not up into the sky, that don't have all the colors in them so that astronomers can see colors in the sky. And you can Google this subject, light pollution, and find a lot of good suggestions for civic action. It's one of the environmental causes of the 21st century, that we stop making the Earth so brightly lit from space.
Okay, thank you for your call, Nick. Let's next go to Jim in San Francisco. Jim, welcome to City Visions.
Ken, actually.
Okay, Ken, welcome to the program.
All right, thank you. I was curious. I think there is, just to top off that last comment, there is, I think, a lights-out day around the world. But my question is, I'm fascinated with what I thought were pictures. They're actually illustrations. I'd love to see a photo of it, of the magnetosphere, what surrounds Earth. And apparently we're in a magnetic field. We're all affected by it. We have iron in our bodies. It's sort of a fascinating, beautifully illustrated picture on your Wikipedia if you look up magnetosphere. I'm just wondering, are there any actual photos of these magnetic images? Can they be seen of Earth? And can you just talk about that in general and how that it might affect Earth and us?
Okay, great question. So I think most people probably know, but let's just start at the beginning. The Earth is a magnet. Just like you had magnets when you were in elementary school and you could see little iron filings sprinkled around them and showing the magnetic influence or the zone of influence of a magnet, our planet Earth turns out to be a magnet. Deep inside the Earth, there's actually magnetic materials. And so surrounding the Earth is this bubble of magnetic influence, which, as you say, is called the magnetosphere. Sounds like something out of the X-Men, but it's a real scientific concept. And when we first sent rockets up into space, one of the first aims of our space program was to prove that the magnetosphere was there. The way we do it is that the magnetic zone of influence actually traps little charged particles flowing out of the sun. Many people don't know this, but the sun actually has a wind. Just like a wind can blow from weather changes here on Earth, there is a wind blowing out of the sun. The sun actually boils atomic particles off its super hot surface, and those particles travel quite fast out into the solar system, and some of that wind, some of that flow of particles from the sun actually goes by the Earth. And the magnetic bubble, the magnetosphere, actually protects us from those particles. Instead of those particles coming down into the atmosphere straight, they're trapped by the magnetic bubble around the Earth. They go around and around in the Earth, and the only place they can come down is the north and south pole of magnetism, which is roughly in the same zone as the north and south pole of the Earth's spin. So a way to see this effect is to travel up to where it's north, whether you just go up to Alaska or even more northern climes, and then look up in the evening and see what you see. And very often you see these charged particles from the sun coming down into the atmosphere. As they hit the air, they cause a glowing curtain of light in the air, and that's called the northern lights or the aurora. So the aurora is a way to actually take a photograph of the effect of this magnetosphere on our planet.
Okay, we're going to take a final station break, and then we'll continue. We are talking today with Andrew Fracknoy, professor of astronomy at Foothill College. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website at klw.org. Now, Andrew, I'd like to ask you, one of the occupational hazards, I imagine, of being an astronomist is being accidentally introduced as an astrologist. And I don't know if that's what motivated you to write down an astrology defense kit, which is online and can be accessed by people out there. Tell us what motivated you to do that and what you have in your defense kit.
Well, this is a fun story, too. This is, I think, now quite a bit lost in history, but there was a time when one of the biggest news stories of the Reagan era, when Ronald Reagan was president of the United States, was the revelation that Mrs. Reagan, Ronald Reagan's wife, had hired an official astrologer for the White House, and that the president's schedule was actually being vetted by this astrologer. And there were days, for example, when they wanted to have like a summit conference with Gorbachev of Russia or one of the other world leaders, and the astrologer said, no, this is a bad day for meetings. And they skipped that day and moved the meetings to another day. So there was this very influential astrologer who in a way, had some control over the president's schedule in the 1980s. And this eventually got out when a very proud banker who was the chief of staff for the Reagan administration, Donald Regan, was fired, and he wrote a very revealing book about the Reagan administration. This was part of the revelation. So at that time, we astronomers are always asked, well, what do you think? What do you think? The White House was run by an astrologer. And that's when I thought to myself, I needed to write down in everyday language why we don't believe in astrology. Because for many people, astrology, astronomy, it's all stuff in space. Why couldn't there be some influence on our love lives by the planets or the stars? So I wrote this astrology defense kit as something that the typical astronomer could say to the public or to the media to explain what the problems are with astrology, why astrology doesn't meet scientific tests. We've tested astrology hundreds of times, and it's failed every test. And that's how the defense kit came about. It was all because of the Reagan administration hoopla about astrology.
And what are some of your basic arguments? Obviously, there are a lot of people in this country who believe in astrology. So what, in a nutshell, are some of the simplest arguments that you give?
Well, there are a lot of arguments, but one of the things that I think is a very easy thing for most people to get is why would astrology at the way that you read it in the newspapers be at all meaningful. The astrologers divide everyone into 12 categories, right? There are 12 signs of the zodiac that you can read about when you look at astrology columns. That means 1/12 of the world will have the same kind of day, will have the same things happen to them. Would you believe that? That if you divide all the people in the world into 12 bins, everybody in 1/12 of the world is going to have the same kind of day or the same kind of experience? Seems very, very unlikely. The main thing that we astronomers ask is, what's the mechanism? How would the planets or the stars be able to affect our love life or our choices of mates or our work issues? There is no connection between us and the stars and the planets that would go across those vast distances and have an influence. So until the astrologers come up with some kind of mechanism, something that can go from the planets down to each individual person on Earth and affect them, gravity doesn't do it, the tides don't do it, electricity doesn't do it, magnetism doesn't do it. We've looked at all these typical things and none of them work. So until there's a mechanism, we're pretty skeptical about astrology.
Now, you are a fan of science fiction that is grounded in science, and I would imagine some scientists would scoff at that, but you have really embraced it and have kind of championed certain writers. And so could you talk a little bit about your interest in science fiction and how to ensure that science fiction doesn't make the public confuse fact with fiction?
Well, I think there's much less of a danger there. I have to tell you that when I ask my students, or even when I ask other astronomers, what inspired you to become an astronomer, what inspired you to take an astronomy class, very often both scientists and fans of astronomy will cite science fiction. Science fiction is a way to open our eyes to the possibilities. Science is a way to see what's really happening. But as an eye-opener, I love science fiction. I think when people scoff, they mainly scoff at television and movie science fiction. And as you very kindly said, my interest is in written science fiction. There are a lot of authors now, and there have been for years, who have a good scientific background and who write science fiction, which is based in actual fact. It just extrapolates or goes forward from what we actually know
and
about
who are,
the universe.
Who are any of us to really know what that extrapolation is? I'm saying they take a basis and then they use their imagination like anyone could at what is possible.
That's right, except they are better informed than anyone because they've actually studied the facts. And I keep a website of science fiction stories that I found particularly intriguing, just in the way that you say, where they've started with facts and then they go on from there. And so I've recommended that to my students, and it's a fun thing to look at. That there are, for example, there's a wonderful new writer called Alastair Reynolds, who actually has a PhD in astronomy, but then decided that he liked writing better. And he writes wonderful, scientifically informed science fiction. That's just one example of many.
Okay, let's go from fiction back to fact. Let's talk about black holes. I know this is a real passion of yours. It's something we're learning more and more about every year. For our listeners who may not know, can you explain what exactly a black hole is?
Well, this is a great story. It has to do with the death of stars. Normally, we don't think about stars dying. The poets talk about the eternal stars and how they twinkle in the sky. But it turns out that stars, like people, have a lifespan. Stars are born, they go through middle age, and eventually they die. Our sun is still far from dying, so there's no need to go out and get insurance or anything like that. But all stars eventually die, and the biggest stars, the stars that have the most material, turn out to die in so spectacular a way that our theories tell us they should collapse forever. Now, that's a mind-boggling idea. What would happen if a giant star suddenly started to collapse and it would collapse forever? It would, if I can use this technical term, get more and more squozen. Right? As things collapse, they get squeezed. I like to use the word squozen for that. So stars will get more and more and more squozen. The gravity at the surface of the star will get stronger and stronger as you squeeze all the star material into a smaller and smaller and smaller place. And it actually took Albert Einstein and his unusual theories of relativity to tell us what's going to happen when such a star completely collapses. And it turns out what happens is that gravity gets so strong that nothing Not even light can escape. So when nothing can escape, we call that a hole. And if not even light can escape, then its color will be black. And so we astronomers have dubbed these collapsed stars black holes, a place where gravity is so strong, nothing, not even light, can get away. Well, if light can't get away, how are you going to find this? You know, this is a very exciting theory, but sounds like we've dug ourselves into a black hole by making this definition. You imagine you can't find a place where there's no light coming from it and everything's collapsed. And for a long time, we thought that that would be true, but then we understood that many stars are not alone. Just like people are born with siblings, often stars are born in two or three or four arrangements. And if one of those stars collapses to be a black hole, its gravity could pull on the sibling star, and we could see the sister star or brother star being disrupted by the black hole without needing to see the black hole. And in this way, we've actually now caught some black holes in action, actually digesting their neighbor stars for lunch. And we know that these black holes are real. These collapsed stars are real. And they've been building up in crowded places in the universe until we have what we call super black holes or supermassive black holes. We've just recently found one black hole that has swallowed billions of suns, that has already swallowed several billion suns worth of stuff in one black hole. So this is getting to be a very exciting part of astronomy.
Could we be in a black hole right now?
Great question. So in the sense that I've just described it, no. We live in a very peaceful orbit around a perfectly good star that's still very much in its youth, and there's no danger of a black hole being anywhere near us. Its gravity would have shown up if there were one close by. But in a more profound sense, there are theories of the entire universe which say that the universe, the space of all creation, is warped or bent like the space of a black hole, and that the entire universe may be like a black hole. Now, recent observations go against this. Everything we now know about the universe is that it's not a black hole. The way space and time in the universe interact are not the way that I've just said. But that's still a plausible, possible theory of the universe, that the whole universe is a black hole, but so big that we don't know we're inside it. But in terms of everyday danger, no, we're not anywhere near a black hole.
And how long will it be till our sun dies?
Now, that's a great question. Our sun is actually not going to become a black hole. Our sun is so small, when it collapses at the end of its life, it'll actually get to solidify. Our sun will become more like a hot planet rather than a black hole. How far away is that? At least 6 billion years away. 6,000 million years away. That's why I'm not adding a rider to my home insurance to worry about this.
Okay, we're now going to go to an email from Art in San Francisco, who says, please tell us your thoughts about the scientific study that has begun to find out what happened to the water that was thought to be on Mars. This project was recently mentioned in a story on NPR. One possibility is that the water burned off. Could it be an example of global warming on another planet in our solar system?
Great question, and we really have to separate those into two questions. So what he's talking about is something called MAVEN, M-A-V-E-N. It's a new spacecraft that just yesterday went into orbit around Mars. We now know that ancient Mars had a lot more air and a lot more water on its surface. It was much more like the Earth. The problem that Mars encountered is that it was a little planet, and it didn't have a lot of gravity. So our Earth has enough gravity to hold on to its air. Mars didn't. Over the billions of years, the air that Mars had kind of jiggled away, wafted away from it, and there's much less air now, which makes it very difficult for liquid water to have enough pressure to form. So the water either also evaporated or had to freeze. There's no liquid water anywhere on Mars today. And what this MAVEN spacecraft is supposed to do is to study the atmosphere of Mars to see how this terrible loss of the air and the water happened to poor Mars in the past. But the global warming issue actually has to do with another planet, which is Venus. If we look at our other neighbor in space, Venus, Venus has a much thicker atmosphere than we do, and it has global warming run amok. The surface temperature of Venus right now is 900 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the self-cleaning cycle of your home oven. So that's the global warming we want to avoid. And we are learning something about Venus that might help us to take better care of Earth.
Now, you had talked earlier about the top tourist sites in the solar system. We only have a few minutes left here, but could you take us on a quick tour of where you would say, don't miss this site?
Absolutely. And I should tell people that October 25th in the evening, I'm actually going to give an illustrated tour of all these tourist sites on Mount Tamalpais. That's going to be part of the Bay Area Science Festival. So if you're interested in hearing all my tourist sites, come join me in the evening on October 25th on Mount Tam. But I'll give you a few. Mars has a giant volcano called Mount Olympus, which is as big at its base as the entire state of Arizona. Imagine one mountain, by the way, it's three times the height of Mount Everest, and as big around as the entire state of Arizona. That's a mountain. So I think that's going to be the definition of macho in the future. You will not be a macho tourist until you've climbed Mount Olympus on Mars. Another place that I like a lot is the Verona Cliffs on a moon of Uranus is called Miranda. There's a cliff almost 10 miles high, but the gravity's so low, if you leaped off, you could have 10 to 15 minutes before you die. You'd float down so gently that it would take you 10 to 15 minutes to fall the 10 miles or so on these Verona cliffs. And I think bungee jumping is going to be very exciting on those Verona cliffs.
Where else?
Well, another place that I really like to go is the rings of Saturn. Saturn is surrounded by billions of little icy fragments all organized into a traffic pattern called the rings of Saturn. And there's one ring that's off by itself. All the rings are kind of together, making the spectacular ring that people have heard about around Saturn. But there's one ring off in its lonesome called the F ring of Saturn. And we've wondered, and now I think we know, why there's this single ring quite separate from the others. Looks like they're two little shepherd moons, just like a sheepdog will cause a flock of sheep to be organized. These shepherd moons keep the F ring of Saturn very thin and very beautiful. So that's another place I'd love to go.
Okay, so to leave our listeners with this, what in the next 5 years are you most excited about learning about that we could we think we might know 5 years from now?
Well, that's very hard to answer, but let me give you two. One is that next year, we're going to, for the first time, have a spacecraft go by Pluto. Pluto has been much maligned. It got demoted from a regular planet to a dwarf planet, but we've never gotten any pictures of it. And next year, the New Horizons spacecraft will go by Pluto, and we will have pictures of Pluto for the first time. So I'm very excited as a Pluto fan. The other thing I'm really excited about is exactly what we talked about earlier, the study of planets. I expect that in the next 5 years, we will know tens of thousands of planets out there. There will be many other Earths discovered, and we will be on our way to finding not just Earth-like planets, but maybe really Earth 2.0, things that duplicate our atmosphere, our environment, and maybe even radio listeners of an alien kind.
Okay, well, that is City Visions for this evening. My guest this evening was Andrew Fracknoy, professor of astronomy at Foothill College. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
My pleasure. It's been fun exploring the cosmos with you.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join my co-host Joseph Pace next Monday for a conversation about the Fertile Ground Art Exhibit, a new joint project of the Oakland Museum and the San Francisco MoMA. You can start that conversation now by sending an email or text to cityvisions@kalw.org. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.